In another fraught week politically, with the Trump campaign demanding CNN retract its poll showing Biden ahead of Trump by 14 points, our political mavens, Alexander Hirsch, political scientist at UAF, and Nate Bauer, director of the UA Press, are in with analysis. Nate Bauer says, along with historical polling numbers, absentee balloting and COVID-19 continue to be unknowns.
On June 10th, it seems like the biggest open question to me is what the technical details and what the process of November 3rd elections are going to look like. Partly because there's evidence to suggest that they will be fraught and disrupted, if not by the Trump administration or the Justice Department or state parties, then by leftover COVID concerns or, you know, I think we're seeing evidence right now of the beginnings of a second wave. And so if we're back to a point where people feel unsafe going outside of their homes, there are only some states so far that have listed fear of contracting a dangerous disease as a legitimate reason for getting an absentee or a mail-in ballot. And even in those places that have recognized that as a legitimate reason, I think it's an open question whether people are going to go through the effort and sometimes confusing and convoluted process of requesting a ballot. All of those questions have the potential to affect November's election in big ways. And the other reason why I think that that's the biggest question that we have to speculate about right now is that Joe Biden has a historic lead in polling over Donald Trump. I think I've read multiple analyses that say that there has not been an election, a general election on record, in which someone has had as big a lead as Joe Biden has over Donald Trump in polls and has not gone on to win the election.
Yeah, I can comment a little bit on that. 2 months ago, the RCP polling average, that was the Real Clear Politics polling average, was 6.3 points ahead. Biden was 6.3 points ahead in the polling average, according to the RCP poll, 2 months ago. And as of today, Biden is up 8 points, which is a poll of polls, an average of polls overall. And so there's a historic gap between the two candidates running for president, and it's widening. That's the other thing that's worth noting. For now, anyway, it's widening. And I think, you know, you look at the history of modern polling, and what you find is that there's a lot of fickleness around polling, right? So when a dominant media narrative portrays the incumbent in a given light, that will have a huge impact on what the polls reflect. But what you can do is, despite the peaks and valleys of the polling as it will continue to process over the course of the next couple of months, what you can do is look at the history of polls that have been relatively accurate in terms of who they forecasted to win any given election. And those are the polls that you trust, because their methodologies tend to be rigorous enough to breed trust. If you look at all of the polls that are the most trustworthy, I mean, Monmouth, for instance, Marist, they have Biden up nationally. But also, if you go and you look into, for instance, the Rust Belt states that tend in the modern history to vote blue, that voted red in the Electoral College in 2016, Biden is up in those states as well. In fact, if you want to find a poll in which Trump was portrayed as leading, you have to go back like 3.5 months at this point. There's no poll that has Trump leading, right? So that's another thing to notice. And here's the other thing I would say is that in particular, it's worth trusting the polls that rely upon phone calls, right? So there's a difference between polls that are kind of internet survey type polls and polls that draw upon phone call data. And it's the phone call polls that tend to be more accurate. And there are three polls, phone call dominant, methodologically speaking, polls that have Biden up double digits right now. And that's Monmouth, ABC, Washington Post, and CNN. CNN has Biden up 14 points at this particular moment. So that's just some additional context. Fox News has Biden up 9 points in Wisconsin, which is amazing, because 3 months ago, it was very close between Biden and Trump. I think there's two things happening, right, Nate? I mean, one thing that we could point to is that Biden has consolidated the nomination. And so that'll have an effect on the polls. The other thing has to do with how Trump's leadership in a time of COVID crisis has been perceived by the American public. That's another factor. And then the last factor is, of course, George Floyd and the circumstances surrounding his death and the social movement that has galvanized in the wake of his death.
I also would note that there's also, at the same time that there's polling of Joe Biden versus Donald Trump for the general election. There's also polling that goes back a long time, the tradition of polling like approval, like presidential approval. And in just 1 week, I think that there are polls, maybe it's an average of polls that suggest that his approval amongst survey respondents has gone from, I think, 49% to 39%, which is a remarkable drop. I also don't think that there's historical precedent for that occurring in that short amount of time for an approval rating to drop 10 points, I think is historically remarkable. So with all of that in mind, I think that if people want to imagine a scenario, at least right now, and of course, as Alex mentioned, things can change. And I think anybody that claimed to have any guess as to the way the first 6 months of 2020 have gone is kind of loony. So a lot can change, you know, between June and November. But it would be remarkable for that to happen, I guess, is the point. It would be unlike anything in history if things changed from the situation that they're in right now in terms of presidential approval and general election polling. Based on that data, it would be without precedent in history for things to shift and for Donald Trump to win a second term. So with all that said, I think that if people want to imagine a scenario in which Donald Trump wins, that the general election doesn't look like a normal general election, that it's something where turnout is either way, way down or disproportionate compared to historical trends and demographics. There's strong suggestions that if we're doing some kind of heavily hybrid kind of situation where there is some in-person voting, but there's also a large amount of mail-in and absentee voting, that probably means that we won't have full results or even like large portions of results for the election, you know, that we're used to having it now basically on that same day or that same night or the next day. And it seems likely that that won't be the case this time around. And so if there's a 3-day window or a 4-day window or a week long window of time in which we don't know large portions of the general election results, you know, that first week in November, that kind of opens the door, I think, to a lot of different chicanery spin by either or both sides and probably across a large spectrum of media narratives. We're not too young to remember the year 2000 in Florida. I think that's just one state. And I think that was just like basically one county or a few counties where there were disputed election results. We could be looking at a scenario like that for multiple states. Alex mentions Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin. It's true that polling doesn't suggest that it's going to be especially tight in any of those places right now. But if there are multiple battleground states where we're not clear about what the results are on November 4th, that's just one more, I think, narrative that can get spun up and heavily dramatized. And who knows what the results of that could be.
I think whether or not participation rates in voter behavior in terms of the election drop if it's predominantly mail-in, that's one factor that's going to be important to watch for. The other factor that I think increasingly is going to be important to monitor is what is the dominant meta-narrative that emerges in our society, in our culture, in our politics that defines what the election is actually about. Right. So if the election is predominantly understood to be about race and gender, as arguably it was during 2016, that'll be one thing. But the election could be popularly understood to be about crisis and how leadership manages a crisis. Right. That could become a dominant trope in terms of how people are interpreting what the election is about. Still, yet another option, people could understand the election to be about the economy. Now, of course, the election is about all these things and a lot more. But I imagine that in the ensuing months, we're going to see a struggle on behalf of both campaigns to try to articulate a governing meta narrative, right? And so Trump, probably it would behoove Trump and his advisors and his campaign strategists to try to foreground the economy as the most important analytical lens through which to understand the stakes, you know, what's at stake in the election. If you pull all the numbers that we're looking at, they're interesting. If you look at the polling numbers around just do you approve of President Trump's handling of the economy, I mean, the numbers look really different than how they look presently, So I expect that the Trump campaign will be trying to spin up the economy as the thing that everyone should be concerned with, the variable that voters should have at the forefront of their minds. Whereas I expect the Biden campaign to be saying, no, this is about race and gender, or this is about crisis and leadership's relationship to crisis. And so who wins in that kind of tug of war, I think, will also be important just to watch for in terms of what the results of the November election end up looking like.
Biden still has yet to choose a vice president. How helpful or not is a pick for that overall strategy?
Nate and I have a little bit of a debate over this question. I expect what Nate will say in response to this is that VP choices are essentially historically irrelevant from the perspective of influencing electoral outcomes. I think that that is generally true with a few exceptions, but given Biden's age, his VP selection will have more influence or at least potentially can have more influence over how voters are thinking about his candidacy. I think that it's possible that given his age, that he'll be a one-term president. And usually that's not assumed before someone is elected into office, that they will only last the one term. Whereas I think with this election, that prospect will be talked about more, and therefore who he has.
Just because he's old, right?
Because
that's like the main, yeah.
He's unprecedentedly old, and Trump also, right? Both of them are old. And so therefore, because of that factor, I tend to wonder if the fact of relative irrelevance when it comes to VP choices, it won't be to some extent kind of upended and unsettled. And I think that there's more at stake for Biden than there has been in the past, probably.
I agree with a lot of that. I think that the reasons for thinking that the vice presidential pick in this case might matter more are they're speculative, but that doesn't mean they're not legitimate. Joe Biden has committed. He committed in that last debate he had with Bernie Sanders to selecting a woman. So it would be a shock if he didn't follow through on that pledge. The urge, I think, from some on the left for him to pick an African-American woman, I think that that has a lot to do with the current state of things. You know, there are Black Lives Matter protests all over the country, and I think that they don't really show a sign of abating. I guess I suspect that they will maybe not be as inflamed and as passionate as they are right now, all the way through the summer and all the way through to November. But we talked last time about political movements, and it seems now, based on actions by mayors and city councils and Congress itself, it seems like the events might be taking the form of a movement because of the consequences that they've already sort of taken on and the way that they've changed the national conversation. So one of the ways that has manifested is through this growing push to consider seriously people like Kamala Harris and Stacey Abrams and others as vice presidential pick. You know, in my opinion, the biggest reason why a vice presidential pick matters is because that's the second in line to be president.
That's what every presidential candidate for the last 30 years has said is the predominant value they bring to bear in selecting a VP candidate. But I think there are broader political questions when you're selecting a running mate. You go back 30, 40 years, you know, you find that a lot of candidates try to select a VP nominee who is from some geographic region other than where they are from. And in particular, Lyndon B. Johnson for John F. Kennedy, if you can select someone who is in a region of the country where the party, whichever party it might be, is trying to generate more popularity and more political force, that tends to be a factor.
You know, Not a big one, though. I would point to studies that say that I think even in the cases where it has the biggest effect, we're talking about like a single point
or less.
In a particular state.
Yeah.
So I think that there is some of that thinking and sort of trying to balance a ticket sort of ideologically or like public perception wise. Those are concerns. But again, I guess I would just say outside of the uniqueness of the year 2020 and the election of 2020, but outside of those analyses or anecdotal perceptions, I think that there's not a lot of data to suggest that it can have the effect that it seems like some of the armchair quarterbacks suggest it does.
I think the other factor that becomes important for presidential nominees in selecting a vice presidential running mate is who do you like? Who do you want to spend time with? And then there's another question of, you know, do you go with someone who you expect will help to energize turnout in a given demographic, which it would be a political choice, Or do you go with someone who you think would be really good at governing in case that, you know, they need to become president? Or even if they don't have to become president, who can be a, you know, an ally in decision-making once you're in office, right? So those are totally different strategies.
Alexander Hirsch is a political scientist at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and Nate Bauer directs the University of Alaska Press. I'm Robert Hannon.